Slackers Podcast. Phil Tiger. Slacker Podcast. Hello, Slackers. It is Phil Taggart. It is the Slacker Podcast, and we're back again for a brand new podcast. Last week's one with Glenn Hansard seemed to go down really well. A lot of lovely messages from you about that one, so thanks very much for listening to it. We've had a great time in the season. I've got two left, really, and then I think I might take a break off a week or two, because my book is coming out very soon, and the book is called Phil Taggart's Slacker Guide to the Music Industry. I've got 70 interviews in there with the great and the good of music. I'm leafing through it now, like I've completely forgotten what chapters there are in it. Yeah, I've got people like Wolf Alice and Run the Jewels and Biffy Clyro and Charlie XCX talking about, well, here's the chapters: getting started, the first steps in making music, the first gig, music videos, building a fan base, management, image, funding, record labels, publishing, DIY, recording the album, distribution and streaming, radio, online, print PR, booking agent, touring and festivals, merchandise, how to make money, and self-care in music. And this is what it sounds like dropping. Boom. 348 pages, 2.5 years later. And it is available for any musician or artist who needs a little bit of help. Just go to philtaggartslacker.com and you can buy this book, or you can go on Amazon as well. But remember, if you buy it on Amazon, 10% of that is going into Jeff Bezos' already bottomless pockets. So get it off the website. If you're fresh to the Slacker Podcast, I'll sum it up for you. It is a podcast with awesome artists, and we play their early demos. And this one is very special to me because I would rate the band that this artist was in probably in my top five bands of all time. I've been a foppish indie kid at heart. I'm a big fan of a jaunty bass line, and I'm a big fan of his guitar playing probably more than anything else. This week we have got Johnny Marr from The Smiths. I mean, this one absolutely blew my head off. I'd never met him before. I've stood in the same room as him a few times, either watching him play or watching him interviewed. And the guy just matched all of the expectations that I had of him. He was unequivocally the coolest person that we've had on the podcast. And he came in really prepared as well. He was really into the idea of playing an early demo. And I was kind of really hoping that we would get a Smiths demo, seeing as that was his first band. And he didn't let us down. He got a really kind of like a studio version, or like a monitor mix, that was it. Yeah, it was a monitor mix of Gene, which was, I don't think it ever came out on an actual Smiths album. It might have come out in a compilation, and I think it might have been the B-side to This Charming Man. And I mean, to be honest, we could have spoke about the demo just for about an hour. But we got some really interesting insights into Johnny's life in The Smiths, in Modest Mouse, in The Cribs. We spoke a lot about The Smiths, and he kind of dictated where the conversation went. And yeah, it was very, very enjoyable. Probably one of my favorites to record. And I think you're going to enjoy it too. So if you like the podcast, spread the word. Like, these podcasts get out there better on word of mouth than any sort of social media marketing or any of the rest of it. So if you like Johnny Marr or any of the other guests that we have on the Slacker Podcast, then feel free to share it on social media. Or maybe stand up at work. Like, stand up on your boss's desk, take your shirt off and start beating your chest and shout, "I love the Slacker Podcast!" until you're removed from the building. And it's fine if you get sacked. I will give you a job editing this podcast. Jenny, who edits this podcast, is going to kill me. Anyway, right, I'm rambling on too much. The book is coming out in a week's time. PhilTaggartSlacker.com. Please buy it. And this is the Slacker Podcast with Johnny Marr in 3, 2, 1. God, I really hope this is like the best podcast we've ever done. I've run from Victoria Station to get here. Johnny Marr, hello.
Hi, nice to be here. Well, you look fit enough. You're not too worn out.
I'm all right. I had a week in New York eating really, really bad food last week, so I'm like trying
so
my best.
It off.
Yeah, I'm trying to run it off. Run away from my problems and run away from the New York food.
Yeah.
How are you getting on? How's things?
I'm all right, actually. Yeah, I've got a little bit of a cough, which is a bit random. It's not really like me. So if I'm sort of splurting a little bit, I apologise for that. But no, I'm doing all right. I'm good. It's getting ready to go out on tour pretty soon after a break of a couple of months, but which has flown by.
You're going to need to get rid of that cough before you go out on tour.
You know I am, actually.
It'll
yeah.
be vocal zone and...
Oh, no, I'm all about the vocal zones. Yeah? Yeah, game changers, yeah. I saw Tom Jones talking about him on a TV programme, and I thought, well,
if it's good enough for Tom Jones.
Welsh Elvis, it's good enough for me.
Do you have like the sort of like vocal warm-ups and stuff that you do before a show? I know a lot of people have got their tea regime and won't speak to people and things like that.
I should speak less to people, but I sort of like the kind of energy and the buzzer before going on, and I kind of, I'm a real pacer about, but I do have vocal warm-ups, so you have to do them, and I think if you don't, I mean, why not? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think, and all the different singers I've worked with over the years, they've had their variations of warm-ups. Like the Germans in the Cribs would lock themselves away, and behind the door you could hear them absolutely screaming at each other, like a sort of sibling screaming. You didn't know whether they were killing each other or just whatever, psyching themselves up.
Could have been it when you've got like three of the same family in
yeah,
there.
Like, yeah.
I've walked in on their room before they've played a show and they were listening to Queen like at the loudest possible setting.
Well, that was either before I joined or afterwards.
I think there was because
almost immediately after I left the Cribs they did a Queen song, because they knew I had a little bit of a, let's call it a blind spot to Queen, but they grew up really loving all that stuff. And, they were big into Queen. Yeah.
So we're going to start with the demo as we usually do, I just kind of like ask, almost like going whatever you'll give me, and why did we sort of fixate on this
song? Well, the song is Gene by the Smiths, and I'm aware that officially it's not a demo, but...
That's it, cancel the podcast. It's done.
Officially. No, because if there's any clever dicks out there going, oh, well, you know, it was a B-side of a track. But as a recording, we put it on the B-side of This Charming Man, but it was a monitor mix, Gene, of an aborted album that we did before the first album. And, you know, when it was picked... I think it was Morrissey's idea to put it on the B-side by him and Jeff Travis at the label. I remember just for having a 5-minute think, like, really? Because it's not finished. You know, it's not... This version we've got on cassette, which we've done with Troy Tate, as I say, it was a part of the aborted first album sessions that we did with Troy Tate. That really has a lot of merit. But... you know, me being, we'd only put one single out before then, and I thought, are we really going to do that? Are we going to put a track that's just a monitor mix out? But
your inner perfectionist would be like, what are we doing? Why?
Yeah. But I soon came, no, I mean, I got on board pretty quick with it. I came to realise that it just sounded great, and it's very unadorned, as people will be able to hear. But the reason really I picked it is that aside from it being a good and sometimes overlooked song, is that to me, it's... It sort of typifies that period of the group before we bounced onto the scene, before everyone got to know us. It absolutely did. We had quite a short, but could have been much longer, sort of apprenticeship or gestation period of maybe a year when we became a four piece. The genesis of the Smiths is in, you know, very, very short terms. At first, it was me and Morrissey, and there was just us for quite a while, me and him writing songs, and Gene was one of those early songs. And then we got Andy Rourke on bass and Mike Joyce on drums, and we started playing gigs, you know, what normal bands do. And what's great about Gene was that it's part of that period before we became pop stars, and we were just an unknown band playing to... you know, 20 people, and it was ever growing when the music press got on us. But I'm telling you, because I was there, this was us at our peak of that early period before we got known, without a doubt. And it was actually quite a brave move to put a monitor mix, an unfinished mix, essentially, on the B side of your sort of hit single.
I tell you what, let's hit in. We'll hit play on it, and then we'll come back after it and pick it to pieces.
Yeah.
Was a demo of the Smiths and Gene, and yeah, the first thing that comes to my mind when you think of like demos or early tracks when it comes to a brand new act is that it's not going to be fully formed. It's not going to be where they end up. But I mean, it feels pretty fully formed.
Like yeah, it does. Yeah.
Where was the growing pains? Like I can't see.
There were some, but not many of them, and that was. Really, because he says rather immodestly, but when Morrissey and I first come together and we were strangers, I've been really working on my thing, furtively away in my room, and I'd sort of had that sort of together. So in other words, like the overdubbing of guitars and on little, I keep thinking it was a three-track machine that I had. I had this little cassette machine that we used to write on. I'd been working on that for quite a while, and he had been writing lyrics for a number of years, so. Our early stuff, essentially the songs didn't really need to change that much from when you heard the demos. We very rarely did demos. I mean, it was only really we did stuff, and from after the first album, we didn't demo anything.
You kind of did your apprenticeship solo before you got together.
Yeah, we did. But if anything, really, the very nascent early, maybe three or four songs out would be out. Maybe even just two songs that the Smiths went in to do a demo with. There was two demos, actually. If anything, the only things that would have changed is maybe the tempo.
Yeah.
And that was, something that I learned very quickly about, just needing to put the right energy into it. And but aside from that, yeah, they were pretty fully formed. I mean, I was very conscious. I enjoyed the arrangements and there wasn't a lot of difference in the way we wrote the songs and the way they were recorded, because in other words there wasn't dead long bits that then suddenly got chopped out.
Yeah,
very very little of
you
that.
You were never a band that was going to run into power chords and guitar solos anyway, like it was kind of like against the grain of what the Smiths
That's right. And we never veered into that at all. If I was doing a guitar break, which happened very rarely, it was a break. It was a composed break. Because, I grew up for the 70s, and as much as I really loved guitars and everything about guitar music, that side of things, that was slightly undisciplined and just boring and indulgent.
Jimmy Page standing out doing a guitar solo for 8 minutes, John Bonham doing a drum solo, Moby Dick for like 10 minutes, like you just couldn't have it. Obviously, like you listen to music before punk, and that was kind of like the staple, your 5 minute track with it fading out towards the end because all the musicians were so drug addled they didn't know how to finish it.
Well, it was because virtuosity was revered. So aside from the taste police being, having been absent for years and years,
yeah.
I don't have a problem, particularly now, with virtuosity if it's someone like John Coltrane,
yeah,
or Ravi Shankar, or these absolutely amazing musicians who are on their instrument telling a story and being absolutely amazing, because it's part of being expressive. It's not just for the sake of it. But what we're describing really are these sort of bloated sort of 70s values, where it was just like showing off, look at me doing all this sort
don't
of
really get
noodly
much,
nonsense.
Much of that anymore. Like when I was growing up in school, we used to refer to those musicians, because there was boys that would play in bands and they could just about hold the band together, and there was the other guys that would do Metallica solos and all the rest of it, and we used to refer to them as the sweaties. Like they're sweaty musicians. They look like they've been trying really hard.
It doesn't. Well, essentially, to me, it didn't really. All of that guitar, kind of particularly on guitar, didn't sound like music, and it didn't sound like the music I liked anyway. It didn't sound like music to me. And so the thing with, you know, with what you can hear in Gene there is a very deliberate, in my mind, a very deliberate attempt to not be any longer than a Motown single or a girl group single. It's very, very important that. To the Smiths, the formation of the Smiths, that I'd for a year beforehand got obsessed with the girl groups, the Shangri-Las and the Ronettes and the Crystals and all of that. So that one of the reasons I approached Morrissey was that for some reason I was aware that he knew about that stuff. And it was only when I actually went in his bedroom for the first time, knocked on the door, and we met properly, and I saw his box of records, I was like, wow, me and you really are the only people on the planet who in our rooms have got this like collection of, because it's very, very elitist and quite peculiar. I mean, they're amazing records.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't just
where
be,
did he keep them?
To
was it like...
He had them in a 45s box, the same as I did.
Yeah.
And, you know, famously, you know, when, you know, it's been told a lot, but it is an amazing kind of story. You know, so he's just going about his Wednesday afternoon or Tuesday afternoon, whatever, and then the door, there's a knock on the door and a complete little stranger, i.e. yours truly, you know, is standing there.
Yeah.
And then the next thing, I'm in his bedroom and going through his record box and saying, here I am.
There's a lot of, you need a lot of trust in someone to let them go through your record box.
Especially if you've never set eyes on them before and they've just come off the pavement.
I don't understand how you like had heard of him. Like, I don't know, because I know Morrissey was like pretty... fervent in this sort of
that was the deal, really. That's
like
how
the
people
ultimate
got to know
fandom
him.
King, wasn't he?
Yeah, because that's how he got to be known in Manchester initially, because he wrote letters to the music press about the New York Dolls. He was the self-appointed leader of the New York Dolls and membership numbering one.
Yeah.
Number of members one. But that's how one of my sort of friends approached him, just as said, you know, they approached him in a record store because he was stood by the New York Dolls section, all two of their albums.
And he's so on brand,
guiding it.
Yeah.
Guarding it, rather. But so for a few years before, I'd become aware of that he was someone who was a singer and took himself seriously as a singer and a writer. And then I think it sort of fallen off for him a little bit. He hadn't been in a band for a while. But it just was in the back of my mind. And so this thing about the girl groups and... at that time in 1980, 1981, in England, in the UK, rather, the sort of the energy, the burgeoning scene, if you like, was what was known in the music press as the new pop, which is actually quite an interesting, to be fair, it's quite an interesting scene. And it was early Simple Minds, Associates, whose records still sound great to this day.
Uh-huh.
And it was this, you know, these it was very specific. And so it wasn't your sort of what became just naff 80s pop after that. It was sort of quite switched on young people who were turning away from punk but still had the DIY ethos.
Was this like kind of like the middle ground between the new wave scene and punk?
Yeah, it was between, well, it was post-punk, but post-punk gone kind of posh a little bit, really.
Yeah.
And, you know, so that was a very distinctive sounding thing. So that was starting to happen. And anyway, so if you were switched on, you know, you were, I guess, you were into that stuff. But so to be into these scratchy, odd records sang by adenoidal, usually girls from 1965 with loads of reverb on was quite unusual. But it just sounded weirder and more interesting to me, that music. So I'd got this idea about that being the direction. But anyway, Gene, even though it's not swamped in reverb, you know, that riff, down and gun and down and gun and at that time, some of the songs I was writing, I was imagining them as being piano riffs.
Uh-huh.
And it's not really that much of a stretch to imagine that
as a
girl group song.
Was this track the sort of like, was this the Road to Damascus track, the Holy Shit track that when you and Morrissey got together, you were like, right, this is working? Or was it a different one?
No, do you know what? What is great now I think of it is that everyone we wrote in, I'd say maybe the first seven, or I don't know, maybe even went for the first 20. Everyone felt like, this is the road to Damascus. No, this one's better. It almost seemed like every song we wrote,
yeah,
with the exception of one or two, that we were like, oh, that's pretty good. But almost everyone was like, the new one was the best one.
Have you ever had a furtive or a fertile patch like that in your life since? Because obviously some songwriters can knock out about 10 tracks, of which maybe one will be really, really, really good. But it must be really difficult to capture that special bond.
Well, I have, whether they're regarded with such status, I doubt, but I wrote, yeah, I have had those moments, Frank, to be honest with you. Say in the late 2000s, that song I wrote for Modest Mouse, Dashboard, was a really big college hit in America, and it was a really good track. I'm really proud of it. And then not too long after that, I wrote this song with the Cribs, We Share the Same Skies.
Oh, I love that track.
Nice
that
one,
that was on Match of the Day for about two or 3 years.
I know, you've made it. But in my mind, I've been doing it a long time, but what they stand up to me, with the best of my stuff. You're never going to be able to compete with the way the Smiths mythology has sort of blown up. But I have had some of those periods. Yeah, Get the Message by Electronic was, I really loved, and I wrote that a few days before Get the Message, before Getting Away with It. I've had, I've been very lucky, but particularly the Smiths, we wrote always in batches of three. Two never seemed to be enough because I thought we're on a roll this afternoon.
Yeah. And four, so you write three tracks in an afternoon?
Always three tracks, yeah.
God, do you come with everything kind of prepped, or are you sitting on the edge of the bed just scrambling away, your brain going at 200%?
Yeah, mostly the latter.
Yeah,
mostly. And the greatest the best times of writing for the Smiths was when that happened, when Morrissey had come around for a songwriting session, and what would happen was we'd exchange small talk, we both wanted to get on with it. We both
can't imagine
loved it.
Too much small talk.
No, we weren't. Well, that's what I mean. We wanted to get on with it because we were so excited about what would happen. And I really enjoyed when I wrote a book a few years ago, my autobiography. These were the bits that I really kind of really enjoyed reliving and writing.
Yeah.
It was so great. And I enjoyed being someone who's got the opportunity to say it,
uh-huh,
let alone live it. But I remember, when we'd both be so excited about getting together. We were together all the time, every day. But this is even the very early days of the band, and including even the days before when it was just the two of us.
Mm.
It wasn't that long, maybe 7 or 8 months. But so we'd have this sort of almost pause, he'd come in and we'd be exchanging small talk for 10, 15 minutes in my little attic. And then literally I'd get a little cassette machine between my knees, because he would be sat on the edge of a table and we'd be honestly 2.5 feet away from each other's faces, and I'd know what the chords were and everything, but I'd be pulling it out of the air often, and he'd be willing me on. And as I remember it, it was like when I pressed the record, it was like we would both be breathe in, and as this thing happened, it was never 45 minutes of trying to make something work. It was press record, and I was kind of channeling it in a way. That's the best way to describe it.
Yeah, well, that's what creativity is. You don't really know where it comes from, but it comes from somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, though, I learned from my early teens, though, to always be kind of prepared.
So
always. And I'm like that now. I never jam, just sit down and jam. Very rarely jam with people.
I think that's the best way, and the best people do, but there's a whole different spark on top of that you can't really prepare for. When Morrissey was coming in, did he just have I imagine he had his quill out and he was penning
parchment
as he went.
In the early days, he brought lyrics printed, but we found that quite quickly after the third or fourth attempt at that it was better if I gave him the music he went home with a cassette, and 24 hours later,
well, he'd done
either of them all,
yeah,
or he cracked one of them. 48 hours later, all three were done, and that never changed right the way through the band. I mean, he was so inspired and so quick.
Well, he's got the oddest sort of timing with melody. Mm. It's not simple pop melodies here and
not
there.
Obvious,
like,
no.
Yeah, it's really not obvious, and you can tell that he studied that. Like, it's not like he's doing it and he doesn't know what he's doing. He's like, right, we're gonna do this pop, but we're gonna do it different.
Well, we developed that. Both of us developed without realizing it. Well, I didn't realize that I was doing it, but when I look back now, you know, the band who later on, when we wrote whatever Panic or How Soon Is Now or whatever, that we were much more skillful. We're still ourselves and still idiosyncratic, mm-hmm. but much more skillful than we were in the early days, which is, you know, as it should be. But we definitely we naturally got better and better really quick.
Uh-huh.
But you know, Gene was so that was about, I don't know, it's around about maybe 5th, 6th, 7th song we ever wrote together.
So that's what, your third session?
Yeah,
writing tracks.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah,
it was. And but I remember exactly at the moment. You know, I remember that writing session very, very well. You know, and
you don't forget stuff like that.
In the time it took me to play it, but I'd had, in that case, in the case of Gene, I had that tune in my mind for a couple of weeks,
was that,
10 days, yeah.
Was that the same session as Charming Man? I know it came out on the B-side in the single.
No, it wasn't. It was before.
It was before?
Before, not that long after. Everything happened very in close succession with the Smiths, but it was part of the early lot. We wrote, for anyone who's aware of this stuff, it was around the same time we wrote You've Got Everything Now and Accept Yourself. The first lot of sessions, the very first one was Suffer Little Children and Hand That Rocks the Cradle. Hand That Rocks the Cradle was the first song we wrote together properly, and Suffer Little Children, that was the first session. And then next session was Handsome Devil, Miserable Lie, and I think it could have been Real Around the Fountain, something like that. And then Gene was probably the third or fourth session.
It's not bad for a couple of days' work, is it?
No, it's good, yeah. We were super into it. Yeah.
I think a lot of people probably work at that for about 10 years and don't get anywhere close.
I don't think we, except for the very, very first effort, we had this song that Morrissey wrote the words to called Don't Blow Your Own Horn. And
it sounds like such a Morrissey track, yeah, as well, doesn't
very
it?
Very first song. And I put music to it. And neither of us were really that happy with it. Really, that was our very first.
That could have been the end of it if it was the first one.
We went, yeah, it was. But we immediately just got on Hand That Rocks the Cradle, so, and off we went. It was like a very, very short, almost false start. But aside from that, we never wrote a song that never came out, and it came out immediately. Every single one came out. Everyone knows there isn't any songs we wrote that didn't really happen.
What did you and Morrissey have in common outside of music? Did you have anything? Because like, you both come from, like, your parent, I might be wrong here, but like, you come from Irish families.
Oh, yeah.
You both went to Catholic grammar schools, I think.
Yeah.
Much like myself.
Yeah.
Also, on a side note, Headmaster's Ritual is one of the songs I think I can relate to better than anything else.
Yeah.
It's the best song ever written about going to a Catholic grammar school.
Yeah, I play that in my current set, and when I sing it, it feels like everyone can relate to it, you know,
yeah,
especially in the UK or whatever.
Have you ever seen Radiohead's cover of
it? Yeah,
it's actually a good Smiths cover. There's not many of them out there.
No, I agree. But what we had in common, it was great that we are. It was handy that we're very different people, personality wise. That was good, and still is. In terms of having stuff in common, well, we had humour as most people,
yeah,
mates, you know, you have to have that in common. We really had that wordplay. We really had in common. Very into witty wordplay.
I think.
Yeah.
My favorite Smiths lyric. Well, not my favorite Smiths lyric, but the funniest Smiths lyric is, "Frankly, Mr. Shankly, this position I've held, it pays away my way and corrodes my soul. I didn't realize you wrote poetry. I didn't realize you wrote such bloody awful poetry."
Yeah.
I pissed myself laughing the first time I heard that.
Yeah.
Like, genuinely walking down the street, I think I'd just bought, Queen is Dead. Yeah. And I was listening to it and I was just like pissing myself laughing. I don't think I've ever done that to like like serious music before.
Yeah, there's a lot of killer lines. A lot of killer lines. Well, in Gene, you know, what again, when you know, when I knew I was going to be talking to you and I thought about it, it's, you know, the lines like, there's ice on the sink where we bathe, you know, how can you call this a home, you know, when you know it's a grave, and Cash on the Nail, it's just a fairy tale. That, I think, was the most, was the first fairly explicit and obvious sign of where we were coming from. One of many, in even, you know, one of the songs I mentioned before, the very first, second song, the first writing session, Suffer Little Children, for example, Oh Manchester, So Much to Answer For, you know, that set off a thing about us. We, you know, we are from Manchester, we mention it in our songs. But in Gene, the narrative of it and the imagery, it was very unusual at the time. And now you go, oh yeah, it's that kitchen sink drama stuff. Mm. Well, this was the first time we really hung that on a flag. And, you know, the stuff that we then aesthetically got connected to and that we inspired a lot of the imagery and the words of playwright Sheila Delaney in those 60s films and everything. It's most, this is the first sort of hint of it in Gene.
But that wasn't done that much in pop music before that. Like, you know, what's that movie called? Friday Night, Saturday Morning.
That was a massive film for us, yeah.
Yeah, like that sort of young desperation, I'm not going to take it anymore. Like, yeah. there was a lot of people in punk rock shouting, I'm not going to take it anymore, but they weren't doing it from the same sort of, I don't know, like, as you say, kitchen sink drama, the same sort of grit, but done with the same sort of wistful,
well, you know,
way with words.
Well, all of that, a thing that we, you know, now know more about, I think a lot because of the band, was forgotten in 1982. It was forgotten other than by people who were in the films and people who were worked on the films. I mean, it'd be using that imagery in the records and on the sleeves and all of that it had never been done before, and it was from a forgotten time, but it was right on the money. It just felt right for the moment. It felt very hip, felt very modern. It was certainly unusual, and you know, went with what we were about, really. Went with the music. A lot of it was without even having to be too obvious about it. A lot of it was about feminism, feminist politics, obviously, which was very much of the times. You know, I'm very proud of that. As more and more time's gone on, I don't bang a drum about it, but I am very proud of it that, you know, that generation of young men and women, but young indie, first wave of indie men. Uh-huh. And I have to give a lot of credit to the music press for it as well, for making it very, giving everyone a manifesto that it wasn't, I mean, you know, I had no idea that 35 years later, you know, girls would be having to like form groups to try and not get hassled at gigs. And, it just, young men from what, who were around me in the Manchester scene and the factory scene and all that, sexual politics were just right on the money. It wasn't even, you know, it wasn't even an issue.
But would you not get shit from people, maybe people that would go to the gigs or people outside of the band for talking about such things, because it was such a foreign concept? Obviously, like in punk rock, feminism was a massive thing, but like in the wider community,
No, you know, as I remember it, well, it's a good question actually. When you say in the wider community, because it's easy to sort of look back at things with rose-tinted spectacles. But as I remember it, the music press, and there was fanzines. There was one called City Fun in Manchester, and there was a bunch around the country. And the network of what was the early indie scene was that everyone was on the same page, and it was almost like it didn't have to be discussed, really. Mm. You know, seriously. I mean, I know the world wasn't, but I'm aware that it wasn't perfect. And it may be, you know, if someone was in one of the minorities, they might say, well, you know, you're remembering it wrong. But, you know, it didn't, musicians and sportsmen didn't have to stand up against racism and sexism and homophobia in the way we do now. It's almost like things have gone backwards, but I know I sound like a bit of an old fogey.
I totally agree. I mean, like, I don't remember Thatcher's Britain much because I was, like, sitting chewing on rusks, or I wasn't even born at that point. Like, but it feels to me that, like, in a from a political climate, like, where you've got far right, a lot of far right, and you've got the left, and there's this big clash happening, and the finances of around the country aren't exactly brilliant. This is what I imagine, like, my Thatcher's Britain is right now. This whole Brexit shit.
Oh, no, I've been asked about that quite a lot. You know, so much so, you know, and that there's got to be something in it, you know.
Well, there's a lot of good punk bands. There's a lot of good punk bands forming. There's a lot of teenagers that are angry.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think...
And it's the same in rap music as well.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's no way it's not... There's no way that it's not going to have an impact on the way writers, particularly young writers, starting out... If we're going to talk about the feelings, and I don't know, I mean, genuinely creative people, particularly who want to do something that isn't just, you know, mainstream, that are outside the mainstream, they're going to have something to say about. It's pretty rich for that. I'd rather it wasn't that way, but no, I definitely
there's
think
there's a lot of really good guitar bands doing a lot, but I can't wait for the real next true alternative band to mainstream crossover and really fuck shit up.
That's an amazing moment. I mean, we were super wanting to take on that mantle,
but you did, because, like, I've done a lot of not researching you guys, but I've just been a massive fan for a long time. But, like, Spin magazine and NME both dubbed you, like, the band, like, the greatest band of all time, and The Queen Is Dead is the best album of all time. So you kind of did have that mantle in this sort of short period that the Smiths were together, really.
Yeah, well, the thing about, I know it's been said by many older musicians before, but really getting on top of the Pops was absolutely like kicking the doors down.
Did you mime when you got on?
Yeah, we did. Yeah. Oh, you could be more effective if you mimed, frankly. You could. And but because before that, for a number of years, the punk bands, who, you've got to remember, when I came out with the Smiths, I thought, I love punk music, but I thought a lot of the bands were just old biddies. I thought loads of them were just old, ugly biddies. I was really on one about my generation. I think, you know, I was really bratty about it. And it's one of the reasons I stopped doing interviews, because all I was doing was just slagging off all these old punk bands.
And, was this like doing interviews in like the 80s?
Early 80s, yeah. You can, honestly, I only did a few, and I was just really on one. Because
who were the bands that you were going at?
Well... I avoided naming names, to be honest.
Fair enough.
But where it got a little weird,
uncomfortable position.
But where it got a little weird was because that was Morris's age group, because we were a different age, remember?
Yeah, of course, you were a lot younger than
but
he was.
But one of that was I'd worked in the clothes shops in Manchester, one in particular, and I'd been around town from being about 15, 16, and I'd been patronised, and I'd had to wear some musicians from the Manchester scene and roadies from the Manchester scene banging on and on and on and on about punk. Now, I had all the Wayne County singles and I had all the Dolls stuff and all of that. And so, you know, I had a sort of education for that, and I like that sort of music. And I didn't need to hear these, what I thought were old bastards who were all probably only about 25 themselves, 26,
yeah, exactly,
kind of patronising me. And also, you know, I was like, be honest, I was like, you know what, I'll form a band and knock you fuckers off your perch. And we did that, you know.
It's a sort of grit that only really comes out of, like, the North, I think, that's really going, right, okay, well, we're going to do this, we're going to fucking do this, and we're going to fucking knock you off. Like, I mean, it came along again with, like, Oasis and stuff like that.
True.
It was, like, a very sort of, like, northern thing.
No, true, yeah. No, it's good. It's you know, it's only really belongs in the minds and hearts of young boys and girls.
But it's the underdog story. Like, everybody wants to be the underdog, and they've got their eyes on who they want to beat.
And that's almost bigger
than being famous.
No, it was great. And I mean, for honest, also for us, Factory, who I mean, absolutely respect. And again, that's another thing. When I put my book out, I was really happy to pay tribute. It's a great thing about being in a position where you can write an autobiography. And one of the great things about getting older, you know, the positive side of that is that you can really get to pay tribute to people who might, you know, in your own way, right?
Yeah.
And Factory was so all-encompassing. And Tony Wilson, bless him, had asked me, at 17, six, before the Smiths, 16, 17, he'd asked me to join a couple of his Factory bands. And as desperate as I was to make a record, I had a real sense of, well, you're the older lot. I had a real sense of like my generation. Yeah. I don't think I was that bratty, but they were older and they were sort of really revered all that punk stuff. And I was like, no. I had a feeling that my kids of my age were going to add a different thing coming, you know. We had slightly different values. We had definitely had different musical values, 100%.
Oh, yeah, well, like, totally. Like the virtuosity of the music that they played in the Smiths wouldn't have worked in punk.
No, and the sound wouldn't, you know, as a guitar player. So, for example, it's very easy to describe, but it's one of the reasons I sounded the way I did, because I was like, I don't want to sound like Steve Jones. I mean, who doesn't love Bodies and who doesn't, you know, No Feelings and whatever, on and on and on, right? But, you know, me and, I guess, Edwin Collins, who'd just come a little bit before, Roddy Frame at the time, a bunch of other people, maybe Charlie Burchill from, you know, Simple Minds, especially the early stuff, you know, in our guitar playing, there was like, I don't want to make too much of it, but it's political. When you're young, everything is like, I will not sound like that. My sound is, it's not accidental. You're very... And look, when
did you have to change up your sound because of the other people who were playing guitar in your sort of generation?
Well, it was good to do that.
You've obviously got it's often talked about, like the sort of revered sound that you're sort of well known for. I mean, many different sounds over the years, but like especially that one. Did you ever go like look over at Orange Juice and Edwin Collins and be like, fair enough, I'm going to change new pedal, new guitar.
No, I did. I did.
Ditching the Rickenbacker.
That's right. And you should do that. I think that's great. What one of the things about that, seeing as you asked, is that a load of things. What happened after punk? One of the things that punk did for my generation was that it left you with a load of really narrow options, to describe it in guitar is actually a pretty handy way. So, I'd already learned to play. You know, like James Williamson was still probably is my favourite ever guitar player from the Stooges. So I've got no issue with like really loud gnarly guitar. But again, you know, you want something for your own generation. And so after punk, it was like, okay, no, you couldn't play with distortion. That was too rockist. You couldn't play with a load of effects, really. These were the options left open to me. So if you were the guitar player in a four-piece band, as I was, and you were the one who's holding up all the melody and all the rhythm, there's no keyboards and there's no whatever, there isn't a second guitar player, you're left with two options. It's interesting you brought up Edwin, because you either play very scratchy to keep that sound going and to fill out the sound. If you've got a clean sound, because bluesy rock was out and a lot of effects was out, you either have to keep playing very scratchy like funk, like Edwin was doing, to fill out the sound. Or in my case, you end up playing lots of these arpeggios and ringing and all these little tunes to keep the sound going. Otherwise, it just goes strum, dead.
Yeah.
And so that helped me out. Those politics, or musical politics, absolutely helped me out.
And taking back in from the Phil Spector sort of like arrangements and stuff
absolutely.
As well. That's a big on the style. So like, you know, this Smiths Live Fast, Die Young, you know, with like, what, how many years? Like, was it like five?
Just
six?
About five, I think.
Yeah, just five.
Yeah,
5 years left. Like the legacy that, I mean, is still. I mean, there's teenagers still running about in Smith's t-shirts. I bought a load of 7-inch from HMV, and they were on discount. And I brought them home, and I realized they're on discount because they're all fucking warped.
Yeah, that's nice, you know, one. The record. You know, I sort of, I think I fixed that in the 2000s. Yeah, the record company were like pretty, they were off the case in the 90s.
Yeah, no, but like, I mean, there's certain bands that will live forever when it comes to teenagers and like especially teenage boys. I'm speaking from experience. Like, kids will always play Nirvana. They'll always play Ace of Spades by Motorhead.
Mm.
They'll always play Seven Nation Army by White Stripes.
Yeah.
And they'll always try and play the Smiths.
Right, yeah. Well, we, with the exception of Ace of Spades, I mean, that's, you're absolutely right, I think.
It's just all a lot, but with really the loud, dumb,
no, it's right.
Teenage track.
Like. But the thing that we, but with the exception of that, you know, we were different because we were English.
Yeah.
You know, and Morrissey and myself had grown up with, Brian Eno, solo records had happened. And the post-punk thing had happened. So Wire had happened and the Buzzcocks had happened. Yeah. So what I'm talking about, the kind of intellectual end of DIY music had mm-hmm. happened in the UK. And that was massive on us because we wanted to be intellectual as well. Okay, so it's interesting, you know, you mentioned like Seven Nation Army and these dumb, great sort of dumb riffs. Well, but we were about clever, dumb riffs.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
yeah.
And it was in the music and it was in the words too. But that wasn't because we wanted to, you know, display it. Well, speaking personally anyway, it wasn't about like displaying our intellect. It was because because Howard DeVoto had happened, as I've said, and Eno and Wire and these people who had approached. And I've got to say, in my case, well, Susie Sue, I thought, you know, what she was singing about, it wasn't just boring stuff, you know. And so we came out of this very sort of self-aware, clever sort of post-punk scene, I guess.
That time of the sort of teenager's life that I was talking about, it's the same time when you get into the Smiths, you're starting to walk around with Larkin or W.B. Yeats or something popping out of your blazer pocket, half for show and half because you're actually legitimately reading it.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody in my A-level literature, actually, shout out to Mr. White, who would love this because he was the one that, like, he used to teach us through Smith's lyrics.
Oh, nice Mr. White.
When we were doing...
Where was that then?
The Christian Brothers Grammar School in Omaha. He was one of the good guys.
Oh, that's great.
And he was teaching us through... Because he was just like...
What was that, in Oma?
Yeah, in Oma, yeah.
Oh, cool.
He was like, right, I know I can get that. Also, one of the weirdest things, right, a friend of mine put up on Facebook, I think it's almost 10 years anniversary, since Morrissey played the Leisure Centre in Oma. Now, right. The only thing that's ever happened, and we still to this day, nobody in the town can figure it out, right?
Yeah.
Because, number one, he got... Like the Leisure Centre was famous for going and go for a swim and then you'd have a soggy sausage roll afterwards, but he had the sausage rolls wiped off the menu for a week, which the whole town was raging about, right? But the Leisure Centre's tiny and it's like in the middle of, like, you know, when it comes to touring, in the middle of nowhere.
And
nobody in the town has any answers, and we've tried to find out going, why the fuck did he play? Because he played like big shows everywhere else.
Yeah, well, I mean, we couldn't wait to all over Ireland, the South as well. You know, we couldn't wait to get over there, and a big deal was made of it in '85 when we went and we played Letterkenny and Coleraine, and then all these places in the south that people haven't played for a while, Waterford and I think Wexford maybe, and Galway and stuff, Cork, and people,
nobody ever plays those places.
No, people still remember those now. I mean, Letterkenny and Coleraine gigs, I want to say. It was the Nolans who'd played there before that. And so, you know, very different to what we were doing, you know, God bless them. But we didn't think twice about it. In fact, we were kind of on one about going, you know, we really wanted to go. I think that's to do
especially
with
around that time heritage. As well. Like Northern Ireland's not exactly the easiest place to go and play. I mean, the Clash tried to turn up and play in Clinton.
Yeah, that's right. No, it was very different, but it had a real vibe. I played Belfast all the time, you know. That's great. I played there about 6 months ago. I played at Ulster Hall. It was fantastic.
Yeah, it's a wicked venue. So when everything finished in Manchester, like the whole Manchester baggy scene started, where did you sit with that? Did you decide, like, you know, Joe, I'm just gonna take some pills and go to the Hacienda?
Well, I was 24, so of course I did. But also, you know, my new songwriting partner.
That's mad, isn't it? You'd, like, the whole band had finished by the time you were 24. Yeah. Like where, like that? Most bands are just about getting going around that time. Like.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'd started writing some songs with Bernard Sumner for fun, really, initially, and you know, from New Order, and Bernard being one of the co-owners of the Hacienda, it was, you know, pretty much like an extension of both our houses. However, I was not one for, you know, as Noel puts it, running around the Hacienda with his shirt off. I sort of took my chemical experiments and always have slightly more seriously, so I was sort of making music in a basement studio, like just going bananas with technology loops and synths and stuff, and I learned during that period.
A mad scientist.
Yeah, I did. And you know what? It was great. I always like so. I'm known for being a rock guitar player, and I've always been known for being in the Smiths, and I'm proud of that. That's fine. And you know, some people prefer some people in America definitely prefer Modest Mouse, but you know, I'm super proud of the band I formed and all of that, and that's why I'm here. You know, when the band exploded, to be honest about it, you know, it was a really heartbreaking time. It was heavy. It was very, very, very heavy. But it didn't half help me out that this cultural explosion of utter newness in technology, in graphic design, in drugs, in music, in thinking, in clothes, everything. I mean, it really was amazing what happened in that explosion in Manchester in 87, 88. Everyone was talking different. Everyone was thinking different, you know, like young people just had this sort of knowing about you're either on one or you're not, right? Mm. And the problem with that scene moving ahead is that it just got milked and went on far too long.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of terrible shit came out of it. But
it's like a 3-day party when it could have been it could have been 1.5.
Yeah, it's so much. Yeah, yeah. But it was so exciting. And it could have happened anywhere and had to happen somewhere, but that it happened in my hometown. And my partner owned the Hacienda. It was a really good antidote to all that heaviness of the Smith split. So I wasn't running around, you know, the Hacienda with my shirt off, like hugging everybody, far from it. But I was making a lot of experiments in technology. Now, as I say, I'd been known for being a rock guitar player, always will be, and that's what, you know, what I want on my headstone, you know, a guitar player. But I'm glad that I got really into learning about technology. No one really, frankly...
Did you make dance music?
Yeah, loads, but no one really gives a shit that I did that. No one wants to hear me make a hi-hat out of a square wave, right, which I can do.
Yeah.
And no one wants to hear me program synthesizers, which I can do, but I was given the opportunity to do it, and I'm glad
I don't think I've ever heard any of your dance records.
Yeah, Electronic did it, you know, that band they had with Bernard Sumner and Pet Shop Boys.
Yeah.
And I did some stuff with that. I did a track with that band K-Class and... you know, some stuff with ACR, so around that time. But I locked myself away in the studio and, you know, I'd made quite a lot of money and I was still only 24 and I was hiding away from the world.
How does that not go to your head? Like, how do you not end up with, like, addictions or spending it on stupid stuff?
Well, yeah, I mean, I did all of that. That was on the list of to-dos.
Done.
Yeah, crash your car, wear sunglasses indoors, court case... I don't think that was on my list.
Yeah,
but that's part of being in a big band. It's part of being in a big band.
Yeah, you need to have a good court case in there.
Yeah, court case and someone dies, so it could have been worse.
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely. And then the solo albums. I mean, like, I kind of want to talk about the Cribs and Modest Mouse because I noticed something that the two albums that you featured. I know you featured on more stuff from Modest Mouse, but like the two albums that you were on with the Cribs and Modest Mouse, they were their most successful commercially.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Discuss.
Well, okay. Well, they were probably, maybe I brought a melodic sense to it, I think, and also.
By the way, the Cribs will absolutely kick my ass if I don't say this.
Yeah.
Joint commercially because they've had 2 number 8 records.
Of course they will. Be careful.
Yeah.
Don't want to get the wrath of the lads. Well, you know, I bring a melodic sensibility to it, and also, you know, if I join a band, there's a certain amount of attention that comes with it. So I have to deliver on that. Now, you know, I am also aware that hardcore fans, you know, because Modest Mouse had made really innovative, interesting records before I joined. We had that number 1 American album with We Were Dead. I'm aware that, you know, you're going to get, because I know how fans think that you're going to get that, oh, Johnny Marr, well, he's made them more commercial. Well, what I learned was that what happens is you have to go, well, over the years, when you get away from it over the years, let's see if the records still stand up. That's how I'm judging my time in those bands.
Yeah.
So with the Modest Mouse record, does it sound great? And with Ignore the Ignorant by the Cribs, does that still sound
great? I still
go
back to that album quite a lot.
I'm really proud of both those records. And I'm going, well, you know what? They're slightly different, which is why I got invited to be in those bands. And And also, you know, there's a real brotherhood in both those bands.
Yeah, big time.
You know, I mean, the Cribs, it was like being in the family. Yeah. And also, I think they would say the same about being in the Mouth. My kids grew up thinking of the Cribs as family, you know. Uh-huh. And so the thing is, I think both those, if you ask any members of those bands what it was like me being in the band, it wasn't like some mercenary rock star guy who just
you're
comes
just like
in.
Landing in. All right, guys, yeah, here's what we're going to do.
Yeah, yeah. It was, no, I get really, I'm really committed when I'm in. It is like family to me. But you judge, the songs are what you judged on. And I think all those songs sound pretty good.
Because you've done three solo albums and obviously the Johnny Marr and the Healers records, would you join another band? Would you never say never? Or would you just continue making solo records?
Yeah, I think after the Cribs, I kind of went, you know what, this is great. I love being in the Cribs, absolutely. And I love the guys. And at some of the shows we played, nearly every show was just like, wow.
Yeah.
Just so good, yeah.
They're such a good band.
They're great. I loved it. And I kind of, almost as well as in tribute to Ross and Ryan and Gary, I was almost like, you know what, I'm going to go solo now. This is it. This is as good as it gets, really. I've had such a good time. And, I mean, there really was a, you know, incredible time for me as well.
Yeah, yeah.
But, no, I'm not really interested. I don't really see that now. And particularly sort of, 'cause creatively, it's a lot more work, you know, I mean, like, than just rocking up at Reading with your sunglasses on and being a legend, right? Having your own band, running your own band is it's a business. Not first, it isn't a business,
yeah, of course.
But there's a lot of pressures economically, you know. I have to look after other guys', you know, rent and mortgages and stuff, and that's all right. But also, yeah, it's a lot more work because, you know, you have to come up with all the words and the titles and the sleeves and the videos and all of that stuff, which I do in my solo stuff. But that's why I like it. I like coming up with the titles and I like finding stuff to write about and I like singing and I like the shows and having to be doing my vocal exercises. It's much easier just putting everything into the guitar. Yeah. No, because the guitar comes so naturally to me, you know, from being a little boy, and guitar technology and everything, it's like second nature to me. But you have to apply yourself to the other stuff. But I'm not ready to sort of chill out too much yet.
When you were jumping into like the Healer stuff and you were like doing more singing up front, I was thinking about this today, and I was like, when I was in a band, we had our guitarist wrote all the songs. And he was like the absolutely incredible guitarist, great guitarist. And then the band split up and he started out doing his own thing. And he like got into the point where he was like singing the songs and writing the songs. And he was kind of like at the start, like he's absolutely flying, like killing it now, right? But at the start, like the first couple of tracks, like the music was good, everything was good, but he was finding his voice.
Yeah.
And I had to say to him, I was like, well, our old singer started singing when he was like 14, 15. Yeah. You're almost starting to do that now. So, like, do you know what I mean? Like,
I do, that's a trap that guitar players could fall into. But, you know...
And I think that it almost hurts people's feelings as well, because they write the songs and they play guitar all the time. They're like, I need to be instantly good at this because this is what I do.
But I hear you,
it's a different vibe, right?
No, it is, yeah. No, I think you're right, you know, because the people that you're being compared to and the people that you're sort of following and the standard that you're up to, these people have been doing it for 30 years. But in my case, what I did was, with the Healer stuff, I deliberately kind of undersang because I think it was a mistake. And sometimes, there's about four or five songs that I like, but I deliberately sort of downplayed it because I guess I just wanted to sort of ease into it and I didn't want to get into people's faces. You know, actually, I think I was right in that. Mm. I think I had two choices. I had one where people go, oh, well, okay, it's a bit like underwhelming or, you know, you know, the vocals aren't a big deal. Or my other choice was to get in people's faces and be like, and everyone go, wow, that's a bit weird.
Is that, you, Bush.
Is that how you really sound, you know, like Muse? And try and find the middle ground.
Yeah.
And also, you know, the music is actually not even that complicated. What me and my mates were listening to at that time in the early 2000s was a lot of psychedelic kind of rock. And I hadn't really ever done that before, and I'd avoided it when in the 70s. I was into like a lot of John Mayall, and I was into like
Do you hear what I paddle out?
On a couple of songs I did, actually. But we listened to a lot of that. So journalists, you know, when journalists were like, oh, it sounds like Oasis or it sounds like the Stone Roses, I was like, well, you don't really know your shit there, to be honest with you, because it's actually like, it's like very, very loud amplified Peter Green. So me and that
well,
time...
those bands sounded like the Birds.
You
like
think?
The Stone Roses, but
on the second album. So it was a way of... I actually was like, you know what, I don't expect that you don't know what you're talking about, really, because it's a little bit too nuanced. I mean, he said it very snobbily, but I was all right with that. But, it was a process. And the other thing about that as well, the thing with the Healers was like, where it's different now, was that I was representing the other two members of the band who were like my best mate, Zach Starkey, and I love, and Alonzo Bevin as a bass player. And where I'm at now is, it's all about me. But I took on that responsibility. It's better that it's, my band are like, totally okay with me writing all the songs and the songs being about what I'm interested in. I was trying to sort of be a little bit of a people pleaser, I think, and represent the tastes of all the band.
I think that's difficult. I think sometimes with creativity, it's good to have somebody leading it.
100%, yeah.
Because it just ends in heartbreak and everything takes longer.
Yeah, I just learned to be a band leader, I think.
There's more hurt feelings, I think. Like I don't know it from, because I like sort of quit, went out on... I stopped playing on the band, like, and I started doing different projects, like record labels and like writing books and doing this, that, and the other. And I quickly realized that the more people you have involved in it, the more people you have to ask about things.
Yeah.
So I always think maybe just doing it yourself's better.
And you know what? It's the chemistry of all teams, not just in bands, but I know about bands that some people don't want to be leaders.
Mm.
You know, that's what makes a really band have that sort of chemistry. I mean, Andy Rourke, you know, my relationship with Andy all the way from being a teenager to the present day, he's sort of like, it's a bit like Tortoise and the Hare, you know, he kind of like grounds me and I used to sort of elevate him a little bit. I don't know whether elevate's the right word, but so, you know, it's a little bit, I was super speedy and he was like much more sort of mellow, and he's an absolute, that's one of the reasons, aside from his musicality, what makes him an archetypal bass player.
Yeah, and he's
all bass players should be like.
He's
that.
One of my bass idols. Like, I absolutely love Andy Rourke. I can still sort of play a little bit, but like
bass players love Andy Rourke.
One question I want to ask you. Well, it's not even really a question. I didn't know that like you're a Man City fan, and like how fervent a Man City fan are you? And obviously, growing up in Manchester, I'm assuming that you were a Manchester City fan your whole life, right?
You're not one of these ones that just came on with the oil money, you know? No, I went through all that horrible 30 years. 1972 was the first game I went to, and I went to loads when I was a child. You know, so I was 9 when I went to the first. Yeah, so since 1972, I've been a City fan, sort of man and boy, literally, you know.
Well, I think that's a perfect place to end the podcast as a Manchester United fan.
I knew it.
You can see it in my eyes.
I knew that was coming, yeah.
That and the fact that we're getting chucked out of the studio. So
all right,
we
Phil,
were,
yeah.
We're getting
no,
some
good,
eyes
man.
There. Johnny, thank you so much
for
playing Jane and giving me some time.
No, thanks for inviting me. Good luck with it all.